Get away from me. Get away from me. This isn't gonna be easy, but I don't need you, believe me. Yeah, you got a piece of me, but it's just a little piece of me. I don't need anyone these days. It feels like I'm fading away. Sometimes when I hear myself on the radio, have you seen me lately? Have you seen me lately? Have you seen me lately? I was out on the radio, starting to change somewhere out in America. It's raining. Could you tell me one thing you remember about me? Memory. She said she loved to watch me sleep. She said it's the breathing. It's the breathing in and out and in and all. Have you seen me lately? Have you seen me lately? Have you seen me lately? I was out on the radio, starting to change somewhere out in America. It's raining. Could you tell me one thing you remember about me?
That was a cover of the incredible Counting Crows song, Have You Seen Me Lately? The cover was performed by me, Sarah Schaefer on vocals, and Sarah Schaefer on piano. I know you were probably like, oh, whoa, what professional is doing this? It was me. And I thought I'd open with a song because sometimes at the cabin, you know, we do have music in America, too. You're allowed to bring, you know, whatever you can carry with you. But because the internet is sort of broke down and that's all messed up and people's stuff in the cloud got all deleted, a lot of people lost everything. Everything. They lost their music, their photos, their videos, their correspondence. They lost their girlfriends because a lot of people, by that point, we're dating virtual girlfriends. So it was rough for some people. They had too much stuff in the cloud. Too much of their lives were in the cloud. And so we still have a cloud. It's kind of disjointed, and you have your individual cloud. It's hard to explain. I'm not really a technical person, but you were allowed to bring, like, I brought, like, I had a few CDs left over from America One that I brought with me. They make me feel real nostalgic, and I was able to bring one old iPod that I had that had music on it. So some of my musical choices that I listen to here at the cabin are limited, and counting, I have the complete catalog of Counting Crows. Now, some people don't like the Counting Crows, and to those people I would say, go fuck yourself. Counting Crows is one of the most influential, incredible bands of America One, especially of the late 90s. And I particularly like the Counting Crows because Adam Duritz's voice happens to fit my range perfectly. So that might have something to do with it. But I love that song because it really, back in America One, it captured how I felt a lot of the time. I felt very lonely. I felt invisible. I felt forgotten about. As someone who was in the public eye, you know, there would be times where, I remember, like, after my MTV show, there was a long period of time where I didn't really have another huge project come out. I had a lot of small things that I was very proud of. I made myself, you know, I made stuff, I put stuff out there, but I didn't sell another TV show right away. And there were times where I felt like I was fading away. And that song really, I really would listen to that and it would, I would relate to it a lot. Like, have you guys seen me lately? Do you know all the hard work I've done? Like, and as someone who is an artist, a comedian, you are reliant a lot of times on being able to put your stuff out into the world and being seen and heard. And there's many times where I, over the years, have felt ashamed of that desire, ashamed of the need to be seen and heard. I don't know if that's a woman thing or just a me thing, but to feel that maybe being too loud and wanting to be seen and heard makes me an attention whore. But when you're an artist, it is important to get your stuff out there and to have it be seen. And so a lot of times I would relate to that song and to Adam Duritz in that moment. I wondered, I wish I had had a chance to speak with him on it. You know, I wasn't friends with him like I was with Justin Timberlake. You know, I didn't have an open line of communication like I did with JT. Anyway, so that song, obviously, I really relate to it now. You know, I feel I put myself in this isolation. I put myself in purgatory, not purgatory. What would the word be? I put myself into this sort of lonely, self-imposed loneliness, this self-imposed isolation. But I wonder who's out there and does anyone think about me anymore? You know, do they wonder what I'm up to? And sometimes you have to struggle with those feelings when you're living in a loner zone. But you know what? I try to remain grateful. Also, I just want to say that if you didn't like the quality of that performance, you know, whether it was my piano playing or my lack of ability to keep time properly or, you know, my voice not being quite, you know, yeah, sure. Probably nobody would have turned their chair around if I had performed that on The Voice back in America One, you know. Nobody would have hit the button and turned around and asked me to be on their team. But I thought it was a nice little performance, and it sounds really good out here in the woods, all right? So go fuck yourself if you didn't like that. And in the words of Fergie, I'm a risk taker artistically, and I apologize if you did not like my performance of that song. Now, of course, I'm referring to back in 2018 when Fergie, the singer from Black Eyed Peas, performed the national anthem at the NBA All-Star Game. And people had a real problem with her performance. Now, it was unusual. It had a little jazzy, sultry summer night type feel. Like, you know, it was sort of like, oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light? And say, you know, I mean, I can't hit the notes like she did. And that's the thing. She hit the fucking notes. She actually performed it well. Now, did it belong at the NBA All-Star Game? I'm not entirely sure. It definitely felt like she was like, you know, maybe like in a sort of New Orleans like speakeasy singing the national anthem. But you know what? New Orleans speakeasies are part of America too. So, I mean, I don't mean America number two, but America as well. So in my opinion, I actually liked the performance. And if people were angry about that performance, what the hell? Like, how uptight are you? I mean, this is the thing. As people back in America One, towards the end there, were so psychotic about patriotism to the point where it was like, you're getting caught up on the song and how they sang the song. And, oh, you didn't respect the flag when you kneeled to to exercise your freedom of speech. As an American, one of our most basic rights to protest. You're an American if you don't respect the flag and you don't stand and worship the flag, like all that stuff. I mean, good Lord Almighty, relax. Oh. Anyway, Fergie apologized and she said that she's a risk taker artistically and she tried something different and people didn't like it and she was so sorry. Now, I don't know. If you want to apologize for something, if you genuinely feel bad, that's your prerogative. And Fergie, you know, sure, go ahead, apologize. But I don't think she needed to. That's ridiculous. Like, sit down. It's the All-Star game. It's not like, I don't know. This is, people just got their panties in a bunch about everything. We had more important things to be worrying about. And maybe that's part of why it all fell apart, is because people were focused on that kind of dumb shit as opposed to, you know, like global warming and the decay of our democracy and Russian trolls getting into our heads and poisoning us against each other. It's interesting. Around that same time, there was this horrific mass shooting. Now, I've talked about mass shootings on here before. And as we know, you know, we continued to do nothing about it until finally Ryan Gosling was killed. I've been over this in an earlier episode. But what happened around that time was there was a sea change. There was a shift. And we saw for the first time the beginning of what later became known as TWAMT-90A. Now, TWAMT-90A is teens who are more mature than 90% of adults. And it was a group that started just sort of casually when teens who had grown up in this sort of late America one and realized, you know, what the fuck kind of world did you create for us? And why are you letting us die at school? Why are you ruining the earth for us? Why are you, you know, they were actually more mature than 90% of the adults. And TWAMT-90A actually ended up becoming a political party. And they ended up being a huge part of the reason why we didn't go into civil war after that point. And they really helped transition us into America too. Now, there are questions about the viability of America too. But TWAMT-90A, these teens, they were like, y'all need to take a time out. You need to go to your DBZ and you need to think about what you've done. And I know I've said that a million times, but that's true. TWAMT-90A gave us a talking to. And we needed to listen to the youth, you know. And that was always my thing in America One, is there was a lot of talk always about that college kids and the young people of the new generation coming up. I don't even know if we would call them millennials. I mean, because at this point, I feel like they were maybe a new generation forming. But these college kids at this time in, like, you know, 2015 to 18 sort of range, these kids, people would always say, oh, they need their safe spaces. They're so sensitive. Trigger alert, you know, they need their coloring books and, oh, PC culture and all this stuff. And I always was kind of like, you know, maybe they're sensitive and maybe they need a safe space because their literal classrooms are killing fields and they're truly afraid of being murdered at school. Like when I grew up in school, I never had to think about that. Columbine happened when I was in college and the Virginia Tech shooting happened, I think definitely after I had graduated from college many years later. So these types of everyday mass shootings at schools were not a part of my life growing up. And I never had to think about the fact that I never had to do a code red drill. I never had to figure out what to do if a shooter was in the school. It was just something we didn't even know or think about. So I think at some point adults didn't understand what the reality of young people's lives actually was at this time. And you'd hear a lot of conservative pundits kind of mocking these children, college kids and younger, for being too sensitive. And we're coddling them. And, you know, they don't want to have their ideas challenged. And it's like, well, they're living in a different world. And maybe we need to listen to them. And I always found, because back then I was someone, I made a huge amount of my income performing at colleges. I was very successful at getting booked at colleges. I'm not going to brag, but I was like fucking great at it. I think there are some comedians that maybe looked down on doing colleges because of this whole idea. There were some famous statements that Jerry Seinfeld made and Chris Rock made that they can't perform at colleges anymore because college kids are too sensitive and you can't say anything or they get too uptight. Now, my thing with that is always like, okay, if you're a certain type of comedian, yeah, maybe you shouldn't be performing to children that young. They are still children in a way, like, because especially if you're doing colleges. Here's the thing that they don't tell you about doing colleges, is that when you do a college, especially if you're not that well-known, if you're not a huge celebrity, You're doing one of their events, free events that they provide for students. You have been brought to the school to provide free entertainment to students as an alternative to drinking or partying. So generally, you're getting the younger students because the older kids have lives. They now live off campus. They have jobs. They're partying more. They're 21. They go to bars, you know. And the younger kids are the ones that generally come to these events. And so you're getting freshmen, you're getting sophomores. Sometimes you're even doing freshman orientation. So they are fresh out of high school. Like it's their first night away from their parents. And you're getting kids that are really young. Some of them are 17, you know, they're children. A lot of them are virgins, you know, like, so if you're doing advanced sex material, if you're doing jokes about squirting and like, you know, like, you know, your divorce and stuff like that. I mean, they're not quite there yet to sort of grasp your life experience. They haven't had enough yet. So it's a different type of audience for that reason. So yeah, they might seem more sensitive because they just don't have the life experience yet to maybe understand your observations. Two, they're also really, some of them are still so young that they're concerned about being cool around their friends. And they're wondering, oh, if I laugh at that, am I now considered uncool by my friends? So they're a little nervous about laughing. And this isn't every school. Sometimes you go to a school and the kids are just hot. They're ready to roll. They're ready to laugh. But yes, they are more PC, if that's the politically correct or whatever it is you want to call it. They are more on the forefront of language. These kids have grown up in a different world. They didn't grow up using the word gay as an insult, like the way that we did, or the R word, or any of these words, like that when we were growing up, they weren't okay, but we were all using them. And then when we're older, some of these words have now become, you know, like these are we've all learned this is too offensive. You can't call something gay in a derogatory way. You don't want to say retarded anymore. You want to use other words like because that is offensive. And these are words that we've had to let go of. And it's in my mind, it should be easy to let go of those words. If your language is so limited that you can't find another way to say what you mean, then maybe you are trying to say it in a cruel, hateful way. You know, why are you hanging on to it so much? Why do you need that word? Unless you're trying to hurt someone. Anyway, back to my point, which is these kids are on the forefront of language, on perceptions. You know, younger kids, they've shown, have a much different perception about gender than we do. They're much more accepting of all kinds of different lifestyles and identities. And, you know, they're just, I don't want to put lifestyle in the same word as gender or gay, because it's not a lifestyle, guys. You're born that way. Okay, so anyway, what I'm saying is, regardless, they're just much more on the edge of what is acceptable and what is no longer cool to say. And my thing about that is I love performing at colleges because now I know where the line is and where we're going. And I'm already ahead of the game. I'm not going to have to change too much because I've already figured out from these kids. And when they talk to me and what they ask me, you know, hey, could you just avoid mentioning this or that? You know, and I almost never get censored in my mind. I think they're just telling me like, hey, it might not go well if you get up there and just start doing like edgy, ironic racism. And I'm there to make money. I'm there to get paid. I'm there to do a job. So there's no problem for me to do that. Now, it's a lot easier for me because I don't have any material that's like that. So it's easier for me. So for me, I don't look down on college. I never looked down on college gigs. I thought they were great. I got to travel and perform in so many different environments. A lot of times the gigs really sucked, and sometimes they were amazing. And you never knew what you were going to get until you got there. It was always adventurous. It made me constantly okay with spontaneity. It made me okay with not knowing what's going to happen. It made me really good at traveling, because when you go to a college, you don't know until you get there like what you're walking into. And I actually had like a fear that I would fuck up the schedule or like show up on the wrong day, or like, because I became so okay with not knowing. I know, you know, it used to be when I was going to travel, I'd be planning the whole thing for like months on end and like, okay, what am I going to wear? What am I going to pack? I need to go shopping, you know, like whatever. But when I started doing so many colleges and not just colleges, but little towns and clubs and theaters and stuff, I just wouldn't think about a trip until literally the night before. I'd be like, okay, oh, I need to pack. Oh, where am I going? What city is this? Like, and it just sort of made me very go with the flow. And not only with travel, but with my comedy. It made me a better comic because I had to be adept. I had to be flexible. I had to write material that worked for all different types of audiences because even though they were all very young, each crowd was different. Sometimes you go to a school and it's a bunch of really nerdy science kids, and I have actually found science kids to be the most exciting performance audiences because they're really nerdy, but they're very smart and they're ready to laugh because they've spent all day putting together those stupid chemistry models, you know, where it's like a couple of balls and some sticks and you stick it together and it makes a molecule. When I see those, I feel sick to my stomach. I hate them so much. I was really bad at chemistry. It was the only subject I was bad at, by the way. I was very smart in all the other subjects. But so these chemistry kids, these, you know, science kids are always like, you know, they're really ready to laugh. They really are cool. Now, sometimes you go to a school and it's just a bunch of duds, you know, it's just a bunch of kids in the audience with their mouths open. And they're just like, huh? You know, I don't know. And you leave and you're just like, oh my God, like, I hate this. But you know what? In the end, it makes you more focused, much tougher skin, thick skin. You know, you don't take it personally if you get there and like three kids show up. You know, you just let it roll because in your mind, you're like, oh, I'm getting paid. It's great money. Anyway, I miss those days. Loved doing colleges. But the reason I brought it up was just I always thought, you know, it didn't surprise me at all when TWAM T90A took over because I just found that, you know, even though they're young and inexperienced and sometimes the younger generation always feels lazier and ungrateful than the one before, in the end, they're more accepting of new ideas because they were introduced to them much younger and they aren't as set in their ways. And of course, we saw that play out in grand fashion when they helped us avoid going to war with each other. So for that, I want to thank the teens for being voices of inspiration. Now, I also wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, whenever there was a horrible incident, like a mass shooting or anything, everyone always say, you know, don't make this political right now. We need a second, okay? The bodies are still warm and you're already using them as a political prop. Or, hey, can we just have a day? Can we just have 1 second to grieve? And I'm always like, well, people grieve in different ways, you know? So maybe my way of grieving is to go out and try to make a change and try to avoid this happening again. I use the metaphor like, oh, hey guys, you know, my mom died of cancer and I would prefer if everyone would just wait until I'm done grieving before talking about finding a cure for cancer because I'm just in the middle of my grief right now and I really don't want you making this a thing. That's just like, it's saying the same thing in my mind. It's like we had a disease, we had a problem in our society and we just kept ignoring it and kept ignoring it and would do nothing. And these things were happening almost daily. Gun violence taking so many lives almost on the daily. And people are like, no, this is not the time, okay? This is not the time or place. And I was just like, and they try to make it about grief. And first of all, grief is an interesting thing, especially when it's a collective grief, when it's a societal grief. I have actually struggled with that myself in that I find there's a difference between obviously your personal grief of losing someone you loved, someone close to you. And that is so acute and it's so much bigger than anything that the country is doing. But then there's the cultural grief. There's the public grief. And the perfect example I would give is 9/11. When September 11th happened and we were still grieving. We're still grieving it. It was such a shocking, horrific thing that happened, and it really fucked with all of our psyches. It didn't matter where you were, who you were. But I actually knew someone who died on 9/11. She was a girl I grew up with and went to college with. Her name was Alicia. And she was a beautiful person. She was an aspiring artist, but she worked in Cantor Fitzgerald, and she tragically died. And it really affected me. It, on one hand, was just so horrible to imagine someone you know dying in that way. It becomes much more visceral. You can see it in your head. And I can't even imagine what her family felt. I knew her family. And to think about what they were going through was so horrible to think about. So for me, it was really hard for me to deal with the collective grief, to deal with the public grief, because I felt that some people laid claim to grief that wasn't theirs. I felt that it wasn't their thing to grieve as heavily. So like, say, 13 years after 9/11, someone's on Twitter like, I remember where I was. I was in my dorm room in Iowa, you know, and they're like going off about it. And I would be like, this didn't happen to you, you know, and it was an immature thing for me to think. I didn't understand the difference between personal grief and collective grief. And it would frustrate me. I also used to get really frustrated when celebrities would die and people would be like, RIP, oh my God, and like make it about, I remember the time that I met him. And they kind of made it about them. And I personally would get frustrated with that. But 1 year, it was the, I can't remember what anniversary, it would, I guess it was 2017. So it was the 16th anniversary of 9/11. And I got frustrated on Twitter with everyone. Every year, do we have to do this? You know, there are people who are actually really grieving family members that they lost. You know, I'm thinking of Alicia and I'm like, God, you know, I don't know how I'd feel if I was one of Alicia's family members and I would go online. Like, I would think about myself. Like, if I went online and talked about her and like, oh, and go through it all again, and then one of her family members saw me doing that, they'd be like, well, you didn't really know her that well. You know, I don't know. It's complicated. So the reason I bring this up is because that year I tweeted something, my frustration about it. And I was like, unless you lost someone personally, you shouldn't be able to talk about 9/11 unless it's the 15th, 20th, 30th, you know, like a big anniversary. And I was just pissed off and I was kind of joking. And then fairly quickly, someone I really respect responded and was like, hey, it's probably better not to judge how people grieve. We're all grieving. And I was like, oh, right. This is actually something we all share, and I shouldn't judge other people for how they grieve. It's your personal experience, and if you go on Twitter and you say something, why do I care? You know, who am I to judge you? Your feelings are real. So I quickly apologized and I deleted it. But then, almost like maybe 5-10 minutes later, I got this message, a direct message from this girl on Twitter, and it was very long and very, very angry and mean. And it was along the lines of, hey, so I used to be a huge fan of you. And I'm like, oh, this is great. Now we're starting. She goes, I used to be a huge fan of you. And I'm honestly shocked. And I know you're going to, this is what she said. I know you're going to screen grab this and show it to everyone. Now, in a way, I am doing that right now, but this did happen a while ago. But I'm bringing it up for a reason. She said, I know you're going to screen grab this so you can mock me in front of all your followers. First of all, I've never done that unless it was a dude like threatening to rape me or doing something really gross. I would never have done that to her. So she's like, I know you're going to mock me, but I still need to say this. I don't care. And she starts going off on me saying that this is literally what she said. She goes, it was very long, but the thing that really made me angry was her saying, it's attitudes like yours that drive people to commit suicide. She made me think that my tweet that I had already apologized for and deleted was causing people to kill themselves because I was shaming people's emotions. And I've never really, usually if someone calls me out or criticizes me for something, you know, I try to hear them. I usually can tell like they're coming from a place of their own hurt. And if I really think, oh, you're right, I did. And I know that I said the wrong thing. But for you to suggest that what I was doing was somehow contributing to shaming people's feelings to the point where they would kill themselves, that's insane. And she just said a lot of crazy, mean stuff like that. And I finally just I responded and I was like, hey, I'm really sorry if my tweet hurt your feelings. I have apologized for it, as you can see, and I deleted it. But I just want to say, like, it's a little extreme for you to shame my way of dealing with this. And I said, I had a friend who died on 9/11, and I get upset about it. I don't handle public grieving very well. It's just something that bothers me, and I'm dealing with it. And I said, in a way, I was like, for you to suggest that. And I just was like, this is so unnecessary, you know. And then she tried to say, well, I don't even spend time on Twitter anymore. Two people sent me your tweet in shock. That's bullshit. Okay. Two people didn't screen grab it and send it to you. That's weird. Maybe one. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe that is what happened. I'm sure this person is very nice, but. And she kind of like backtracked and was like, I'm going through a really hard time right now. And it usually that's the thing. If you kind of like poke at someone, but if you sort of like nudge them, you kind of find out if they're unleashing a lot of anger on you, they're projecting something from their own life. And then I felt really bad because she clearly was in a lot of pain and it had nothing to do with me. And I was like, well, that's what this is about. I was expressing my pain in my own way and it came off and it hurt your feelings. And that's why Twitter could be really shitty. And I tried to say that to her. Anyway, she unfollowed me. And I did not unfollow her out of principle because I thought that we had actually a good conversation about it. But it was one of those things that reminded me of later when people say, we need a second to grieve. You know, it's like, I've just tried to realize that people's grief over horrific tragedies, whether they are personal or public, everyone deals with it in a different way. But what I can't tolerate is this idea of using grief as an excuse to do nothing about something that we can prevent. And that was where I was like, fuck you and your grief. This is actually a moment where I can definitively say that we are all in a perpetual state of grief. And maybe I'm grieving, you know, maybe I'm talking about gun control from the three massacres ago. Okay, I'm not talking about the one that just happened. I mean, that's how fucked up it was. It was happening so often that we didn't know which one we were grieving. And anyway, none of that is funny. But it's just stuff that I've been thinking about lately out here in the cabin. And I wonder now that we're all sort of disjointed and in our little zones and away from each other, how people are grieving America One. You know, are we even grieving it, or are we saying good riddance? That remains to be seen. I want to see what America Three is. I'm ready for America Three in a way, but part of me doesn't know if I can let go of my designated loner zone 281B. It's such a beautiful place. It's all mine. It's a place of my own. Even though I struggle with loneliness, what better life, you know? So maybe if we could work out a way in America 3 for me to stay here, that might be good. Maybe I should write to TWAM T90A and see what they're up to these days. So what's happening at the cabin? Well, I think I've covered it a little bit. I've been feeling these questions lately. And the subject of grief came up because one of the frogs that I talked to, I found dead outside. And I had named him Herbert because that's kind of how he talked. He'd be like, Herbert. Anyway, Herbert, and you know what? It might not have even been Herbert because sometimes it's really hard to tell the difference between individual frogs. But Herbert would help create such a beautiful sound outside. My favorite sound in the world is the sound of a forest at night. You know, crickets, cicadas, frogs. In the winter, it's kind of scary and quiet, but there's still the sound of life and birds. And but in the summer, it's my favorite. And Herbert died. I don't know how he died. But there he was right in front of my cabin. And, I'll be honest, I threw him in the compost pile, but, Herbert had a great life. He brought music to the world, and just like I'm bringing music to the world here. And I'm grieving him in the way that, you know, we all would grieve any life. Did it make any impact? Yes, you did, little guy. Yes, you did. I'll remember you. I don't know if your frog friends will. I don't know what sort of relationship you had with them. I don't know if they were still, if you guys got along or if you were an asshole frog. And then nobody came to your frog funeral. I don't know. I can't speak frog. But Herbert and I were friends, and I miss you, buddy. Before I go, I was wondering, you know, I've been doing this podcast for a little bit now, and I've been wondering, like, if it was back in America One and I was doing this podcast, what would people say about it, you know? What would they, if they were to write a review on iTunes, you know, or Stitcher or the other platforms upon which it would exist, what would they say about it? Would they give it 5 stars? Would they say it was brilliant? Would they say it was, you know, quietly magnificent? I would really appreciate that. You know, I would be so grateful if more people, you know, lots of people gave it reviews. And if someone could, you know, if back then I'd probably be like, gosh, how do you get on the new and noteworthy page of iTunes? Like, do you know anybody? Like, how do you get that in front of the, or maybe if enough people would back then would have tweeted it or, you know, shared it on their Facebook or told their friends, forced their significant others to listen to it. I guess significant other doesn't count because that would be one download per couple. But maybe you force your friends and family to listen to it and just say, oh, you got to check this out. You know, I wonder back then how many people would have done that. Would it have become a hit? Would I have been able to go on the road with it and make a huge amount of money on ads? I don't even know. How would I even do ads on this? I mean, now, but I'm sure I would figure out a way if it got popular enough. Anyway, it's just something I've been thinking about, something I've been pondering out here alone. But you know, in the words of Adam Duritz, I don't need you. Believe me. Bye.